Welcome back to Oscars 173rd and West Center. Later in the Grum during the happy hour, we'll get some different angles of Nick's failed hot dog challenge, where he thought he could do it in 10 seconds. And
I didn't fail. I just found a way that didn't work. Benjamin Franklin said that.
Interesting.
I think that was Benjamin Franklin.
Aaron said, Aaron Papillion, only thing better is if he was wearing the blindfold like the taste tests. That would have looked like a torture video then.
Yeah, it would have. It would have been very, very questionable.
Feels unnecessary. Yeah. Yep, this is a hot dog, all right? Mm-hmm.
Well, yesterday we discussed the possibility of Creighton baseball making the NCAA tournament, even if they can't make the conference tournament.
Yeah.
And, well, what did they do last night? They basically reran what they did the night before, but did it in far more dramatic fashion. Second baseman Kyle Hess was the big hero last night. I had a chance to catch up to him. You'll hear the full interview on our 1620 The Jays podcast, which will be coming out later tonight. But here are a couple of the moments that right now probably is the highlight of the season for Creighton baseball. The 0-1 to Hess is hit on the ground. Base hit! Left field! Headed to the corner! One run's gonna score! They're gonna send Ben North! Here he comes! He's headed for the plate! He will be safe! And headed to third with a triple is Kyle Hess! And the Blue Jays have tied this game!
I kind of, in the sixth inning or the fifth inning before, I had an opportunity with a runner on third, one out, and I didn't get that job done in an RBI chance, and I was really upset about that, but I kind of needed to flush that quickly because I knew as I saw the lineup turning over and our pitchers were nails and they kept us in that ball game, I knew that eventually that opportunity was going to come back to me. And he threw a fastball out over the plate, and I put a good swing on it. I had a discussion with my hitting coach, not an inning before that, and we talked about, turning a little bit deeper, seeing that ball a little bit deeper into the zone, and thinking that mindset, left center field, as opposed to, the couple at-bats before where I rolled it over into the four hole. So making that, in-game adjustment was definitely huge, and I credit that to, my coaches and our approach and my teammates for putting me in that situation.
A lot of room at shortstop with the shift on, the shortstop playing up the middle. And to the right of second base, the 0-1 smacked in the air. It's down. Base hit. Here comes North. Here comes the throw. The play at the plate. Jays win. Jays win. Jays win.
I saw Ben rounding third. I peeked around there, and I saw the throw was a little bit up the line, a little bit short. The right fielder's got a really good arm. That was in our scouting report. So I'm just glad Ben got a really good jump coming around third base. But I just turned around and saw the guys, ready to mob me, and I was just like, let's just let this happen because I'm super tired from the end of the night. I'm mentally exhausted. That's kind of how it is by the end of the game. But I'm just really proud of this locker room because, this past weekend we could have, crumbled, and then these two games going down 3-0, it would have been easy to just, say, oh, this is, the greatest team in the world that we're playing here, and just, crumble in those games. But we stayed really resilient, and I'm just glad that I could, share that really cool moment with this team. It's definitely something that I'll never forget.
So that was Kyle Hess, last night's hero. Two big hits, one in the eighth, one in the tenth. Jays get the sweep of Coastal Carolina, the 13th rated team in the country. They were top 20 in the RPI. In fact, I think they still are top 20 in the RPI, as I meant. Yeah, 15th in the RPI. Jay's RPI improved 8 spots up to number 41. So, they're moving ever so closer up the ladder. And again, RPI is what it is. It's not
the end-all be-all.
It's not the end-all be-all, but it's at least one gauge that we can use to kind of determine, hey, which teams are going to get in, which teams aren't. Certainly last night, huge win for the club. It's still crazy to think about how this team is so good in the midweeks. And on the weekends, it comes up a little short. I had someone ask me about that. Who are they starting the midweeks? Who are these pitchers? Are they sacrificing starting pitchers on the weekends to win these midweeks? And no, they're not. In fact, it's typically a whole staff approach. Shea Wendt, who's a freshman, he pitched the beginning, or I think it was the beginning of the Nebraska game and the beginning of the game two nights ago. And, it's usually, an inning or two. And then after that, it's just a bullpen game. And for the last two nights, Creighton's bullpen has been tasked with going the majority of the game and has allowed just one run in, I believe it is, let's see, last night would have been eight, the night before seven, in 15 innings.
Wow.
Now, to a team that is slugging over 500.
Yeah.
Coastal Carolina did not have an extra base hit in this series. Did not have an extra base hit. This team slugs over 500. They're one of the best power hitting teams, slug percentage teams in college baseball. No extra base hits last night. I mean, they're putting it together with the bullpen, and you know, these guys are, it's really fascinating to watch how this group has come together. It's just now about trying to put it all together, especially for this weekend.
I was going to say, yeah, to start, especially when you consider the opponents that they're going to have on the docket. And we talked a little bit about that yesterday in terms of, what is it, three out of the four teams that are ahead of them right now in the conference standings, they will finish up with in the end of the regular season. And then one versus a team that's near the bottom of the standings, right?
Yep.
But, yeah, like that's what it's about to be. And, I mean, it's super impressive, you know, fortitude from them last night, given how quickly they were down and the score that it was. And to do this against this team, you know, I mean, just so impressive to get those victories like they did.
The estimate is at this point, we talked about this yesterday in regards to the at-large conversation. I think the two things will be settled by just doing one thing, and that's winning. The only way Creighton's going to continue to maintain and improve this RPI, which I think they have to do if they're going to be in the at-large conversation, would also go hand-in-hand with lifting yourself up in the standings. So the whole consternation over can they be an at-large team without being in the conference tournament, I think that's a moot point because they'll need to win at a decent level in order to keep the RPI high. And by doing so, they will also lift themselves up into the top four. They're only a game back of fourth place right now. So I don't even think that's a conversation at this point. The conversation is, can they lift themselves high enough to be in the at-large conversation? And certainly wins like this week will get the attention of a lot of folks because you did beat a team that has been a perennial NCAA tournament team in recent years, won the national championship 8 years ago, and as a team, as I mentioned, 15th in the RPI. Certainly there'll be another opportunity to beat another really good RPI team in Nebraska next week, get the sweep there. And then, you know, you mentioned it, Georgetown's RPI isn't as good, but Connecticut's is climbing. So St. John's is pretty decent. So they'll have opportunities.
Yeah,
exactly. And those games will be on the road.
It's like what we talked about yesterday. There's no world where they climb in the Big East standings and also don't pick up solid RPI wins. They're going to have one will come with the other, or they will not climb and they will not improve their RPI, right?
Right. Like
that's kind of what we're looking at with this team over the last 4 weeks of the regular season.
So we'll have coverage this weekend, Creighton and Georgetown, hopefully. Weather is going to be a little iffy.
Yes.
Starting tonight and heading into tomorrow.
Yeah, the spring weather has finally sprung in terms of, like, when you go to weather.com and you see that exclamation, like, oh, hello, strong storms and wind, thunderstorms. Like, we are definitely entering into that time of the year.
6 o'clock tomorrow night is scheduled first pitch, 6 o'clock Saturday night, and 11 a.m. Sunday in those games. We'll be on our sister station, 1180 The Zone. Conversation I wanted to get into because we touched on it briefly yesterday.
Just in content, I believe, right?
Just in content.
Yeah.
But Dan Wetzel wrote a column 2 days ago now after Reggie Bush, or actually it was yesterday, Reggie Bush got his Heisman reinstated. And it was entitled Reggie Bush's Heisman Redemption and the Fallacy of Amateurism. Essentially, he's saying amateurism as we know it in the United States is dead.
Yeah.
And yesterday was just kind of the last sign of all of that because, of course, the reason why Reggie Bush got his Heisman taken away in the first place was it was discovered that he and his folks got some improper benefits. Well, today, Had that happened to a Caleb Williams, for example, no one would have batted an eye because we now call it NIL.
I was going to say, now that probably happens and we just don't hear about it. Like, I do know that apartment complexes and certainly vehicles are built into a lot of contracts that players get today from the NIL collectives.
But what was interesting here, and I'm going to go through part of this column because there's some of it that I still find a little bit disingenuous, and it does lead into a broader conversation. And Wetzel, as he points out, for those of you who aren't familiar, amateurism essentially was born in the late 1800s as the sports culture is growing in England and, you know, people are competing against each other. The wealthy elite who spent their times competing in these games would go out and hire ringers. We all call them ringers today. The people that, you know, who obviously are really good at sports just so that they can have bragging rights on the playing
field. So they would pay them.
Right. So they would go for, you know, they would, as Wetzel writes, the average folk would toil 6 days a week in factories or farms owned by the sporting upper class. For them, there was no time for games, let alone the time or energy to master them. But somewhere along the way, in an effort to influence the outcome of a rugby match or a dressage competition, some rich guy decided to pay one of his workers to train for competition rather than perform manual labor. He stacked the team, ringers, as they were called. To combat this, the other rich men came up with the idea that not only should paying athletes to participate be prohibited, but such behavior was morally and ethically bankrupt. You play for the love of the game, not food and housing, they decreed. This was, of course, easy to say when you already have food and housing. He quotes a New Hampshire, University of New Hampshire professor who wrote in a 2002 paper, "The genesis of amateurism was built around elitism and exclusion, allowing the wealthy to regulate working and lower class people behind the screen of rhetorical morality." As Wetzel writes, in short, amateurism is a terrible, unfair, ethically bankrupt idea created by terrible, unfair, ethically bankrupt people who sought to rig everything, even simple games, in their favor. Regardless, the International Olympic Committee and later in America, the NCAA, seized on the idea and baked it into the ethos of their organizations that playing for the love of sport was somehow pure. Being paid somehow tainted everything and deserved ridicule and punishment.
And that's kind of what, this is me speaking now, that's what the NCAA argued to the Supreme Court, what, a couple of years ago now? They argued that if players were paid, that fans wouldn't want to watch because they want to watch because the players are not paid. Mm-hmm. And obviously the Supreme Court voted 9-0 against them, so obviously they did not believe that. And I believe that Brett Kavanaugh was the one who came down the harshest, saying that doesn't make any sense to me.
Right.
When he wrote the dissent.
So the concept and the birth of amateurism certainly has its roots in elitism and is more a way of looking down at the common person. And I'm not discrediting anything that Wetzel said. I'm not discrediting the history. The history is the history, right?
Sure.
The only thing that has bothered me in this whole conversation now is we swing it to American college athletics, because that really is the last...
It's the last major
bastion of what we have considered amateurism.
Amateurism disappeared with the Olympics with the 1992 games, right? Because that's when the Dream Team comes into existence.
Right, and actually it started to disappear before that because athletes were starting to get compensated
money
back in the 80s.
So at the very least, it disappears with the Olympics, which, again, was long viewed as this amateurism,
yep,
you know, where athletes wouldn't go pro. And thus they would forfeit lots of money so they could participate in the Olympics. But yeah, big-time college sport, well, all college sports, but certainly big-time college sports was the last bastion of amateurism, you know, at this level, at the way,
right,
in which we've talked about it over the years.
Now, unlike, you know, the Victorian age, you know, England and its style of amateurism, the idea and the thing that has kind of bothered me about this is the concept that the collegiate athlete has been held down or, and I can remember the conversation when we were doing the discussion on the Northwestern unionization. This was about, what, 6-7 years ago now.
Yeah, close to a decade.
But there were people that were using terms like, oh, they're like indentured servants, basically calling them slaves, which I hate that kind of language in these conversations because it detracts from the actual subject and it takes things to an extreme level that's just not true. Those of us who have gone to college and have had to pay for our education know the great value of a college education and how valuable that is. You're still paying off your loans. It took me forever to pay off my loans. Nick's still paying off his. So there was value there. No one was ever an indentured servant or anything like that. There was something being gained. The difference now versus what it used to be is that the money has grown so exponentially that the compensation that you get is no longer commensurate with what the value of the product is worth. In other words, college football, we'll use that as the main example, has become so lucrative. It is a multi-billion dollar industry that just the simple, hey, we'll pay for your education, and that's going to be your compensation, isn't good enough anymore.
Because as we've talked about a lot, you know, it's the same as it's always been in terms of college. The cost of college has gone up, but the cost of college has not gone up at the same rate as the television revenue has gone up in college football.
So to use this as an example, and we'll continue the conversation on the other side, I found a story this morning. This is from the Omaha World Herald in 1979.
Okay.
And this is, I believe Tom Ash was the one who wrote this article for the World Herald. With a new title and a $7,960 raise, Tom Osborne jumped from the lowest paid current coach in the Big Eight Conference to the highest. He got basically an $8,000 raise. Tom Osborne's salary and his new contract that went from 1979 to 1983 paid him $44,000. That's what Tom Osborne made, and he was the highest paid coach after the approval of this contract in the Big Eight Conference ahead of Barry Switzer in 1979. The average median income of a U.S. household in 1979 was $16,530. So, in other words, Tom Osborne was making about a little more than 2.5 times the average American salary to be the head coach at Nebraska.
Okay.
Just to put that into perspective. Fast forward now, 45-ish years, Matt Rhule is making $5.5 million this year to coach Nebraska football.
That's it.
The average U.S. salary, and remember, that's just the first year. His contract actually elevates.
Oh, that's
It'll be paying him $12 million by the end of the
season. It's above 10.
So we're just looking year to year. But the average U.S. salary in 2024 is a shade under $64,000. Matt Rhule will be making 86 times the average U.S. salary. So in 45 years, it's gone from the Nebraska head football coach making 2.5 times the average salary to 86 times the average salary,
which then kind of goes back to what I was just saying. The cost of college has gone up, but it has not gone up like that.
No.
And the salary yet of the college coaches has, and now finally the players are able to get a little bit off of their name.
Precisely. But on the other side, I want to continue this conversation about, you know, the death of amateurism and what it means.
Because it's a fascinating question.
It's a very fascinating question because there's something about the amateurism at in British times, the birth of amateurism as we know it, and how it has traditionally been done in the United States. And there's something else at stake here, which is not being discussed as Pete Crow Armstrong hits
Oh, Nick, you hear that? That's a Cubs update.
That might be his first major league. I think that's his first major league home run.
Oh, that's cool. Good for that guy.
I think.
Congrats to that man.
I don't remember if he had done it before.
I don't know who that man is.
He is our number one prospect, and he's in for Cody Bellinger, who is now on the IL.
Wow.
And the Cubs have taken a 3-1 lead in the sixth. That is cool and very awesome. But we will have more. And if you want to join in on the conversation, you can as well. 402-951-1620. But first, a word for my friends with GoodGuysSaveLives.com. That's the website you can go to find out more about how you can donate organ and tissue after you're gone and make a difference, make a life-changing, life-saving difference. Do you know that one healthy donor can save up to 8 lives just by organ donation? And dozens more can be impacted positively in their lives because of tissue donation. There are cancer patients who have undergone breast cancer and have had to get reconstructive surgery. Well, it's donated skin tissue from generous donors that allow that to happen. Same with car accident victims and donated bone grafts, corneas that can be used to restore the gift of sight. All of that is possible. And the best part is about donor registration is anyone can do it. It doesn't matter how old you are. It does not matter your health condition. Anybody can do it. And it's absolutely free to your family, and traditional funeral practices can still be executed after you are gone and after a successful donation. So next time you renew that driver's license or that hunting and fishing license, check off the donor box on the back and become an organ and tissue donor today, or visit GoodGuysSaveLives.com. That's GoodGuysSaveLives.com.